The way we live in Australia has changed. We're trading backyards for balconies and courtyards, and this has resulted in around 1 in 5 Australians living in apartments today. That's up from 1 in 7 in the 1990s. According to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, of the 10 million or so dwellings in Australia, around 10% of these are what they call attached dwellings, apartments, built in 8 capital cities over the 17 years or so to December 2018. And the trend to medium and high-rise living is only going to increase as more of us are going to want to trade space, you know, big backyards, for being in the right place, living closer to work, to lifestyle, to facilities, to amenities. So, are apartments good investments? Well, the answer is yes and no. Not all apartments are the same. Some will make great investments, substantially increasing in value over the long term, but many of those in the high-rise towers built in the last 15 years or so, they're going to continue to underperform with poor, if any, capital growth in the foreseeable future. But looking back over the last decade, many apartments that would have been classed investment grade, apartments in good locations, they didn't perform anywhere near as well as houses, particularly in Melbourne and a little bit in Brisbane as well. So today I'm going to dissect a recently produced report by Stuart Weems on the performance of investment grade apartments, and there are some very valuable lessons in there. So our chat is going to be of interest to you, whether you're interested in property investment or even buying an apartment for your own home. And of course, I'm going to share my regular mindset message with you. So welcome to today's episode of the Michael Yardney Podcast.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment, and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropole, who specialize in helping you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now, here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
On the one hand, we know more Australians are living in apartments than ever before, particularly in our big capital cities. And if you've been listening to this podcast or reading my blogs, you'd know I've made a point about avoiding investment stock. You know, those Me Too apartments and high-rise multi-apartment towers. They've got no scarcity. They're built out of paper mache. And as I've explained, they're very different from what used to be called flats and what I now call investment-grade apartments, medium-density walk-up apartments in great positions with good floor plans, with balconies, with courtyards, and these are often situated on large blocks of land in good lifestyle neighbourhoods. But even investment-grade apartments, and particularly in Melbourne, have underperformed from a capital growth perspective compared to houses over the last 8 to 10 years. And while the buyer's agents team at Metropole have been buying well-located apartments in Sydney, we've bought very, very few apartments in Melbourne in the last decade and none in Brisbane, understanding that they've underperformed. Now, I know this personally. I know how apartments have underperformed because I own 3 blocks of apartments in prime suburbs, 2 of them character-filled Art Deco blocks. Yet my other investments, in particular townhouses that I've built, have generated much better capital growth over the last decade. So I was really keen to read a new report produced by Stuart Weems analysing the performance of investment-grade apartments. Now, Stuart's an independent financial advisor and author of a number of books, including Investopoly and the Rules of the Lending Game, and he's a regular contributor to the Australian newspaper and a regular guest on this podcast. Welcome, Stuart.
Great to be with you again, Michael.
Well, I was really impressed with your report. It's a very detailed multi-page report. Must have taken you a lot of time to prepare. What made you do this type of research?
I've been thinking deeply about the performance differential between houses and apartments, as you said, particularly in Melbourne, to a much lesser extent in Sydney, but I mean that to a significant extent in Brisbane, although the supply story in Brisbane, or oversupply story, I should say, in Brisbane is pretty obvious. But particularly in Melbourne, I was really sort of perplexed a little bit, I guess, around what is driving that differential. One of my favourite sayings is hold strong opinions loosely. So whilst I believe that these investment-grade assets have all the fundamental components that a property should possess in order to generate strong capital growth over long term, so whilst I strongly believe that, I didn't want to be blind to the possibility that either one, I'm wrong, or two, things have changed. And I'm also cautious to believe that things have changed, because things rarely change. I mean, the papers and the media love to talk about how things have all changed, how COVID will change things. But, you know, the reality is that things rarely change. I've been thinking about this probably for a couple of years, really mulling over it in my head for a long time. It was probably a bit of a cathartic process to really get all that noise in my head out on a paper. And most importantly, I started with a blank sheet of paper. I didn't start with the idea or the purpose to defend my current position. So that is that this is why we have invested, or this is why my clients have invested in these assets. And also didn't start with the current position that it's wrong and it's not going to perform. I wanted to start with a completely open mind and then just look at the facts, look at what has occurred, what are the things that have occurred over that period of time in order to identify, are these investments going to work? If I invested in an apartment, you know, 7, 8, 9 years ago, and I've seen very little capital growth, maybe 50 grand or something, that is not exciting, that I should not be happy with that outcome. And as an investor, I would want to then know, do I hang on, be patient, because often patient investors are rewarded handsomely, or do I realize these investments just aren't going to work and I've got to make a change?
Well, we're going to put a link to the report on your website in the show notes of this, so we'll go into a little bit more detail. But we're talking about over the last decade, where my gut feel was also the same. Well, more than my gut feel, my knowledge is we did client reviews. Having said that, in the decade before, particularly in Melbourne, which is where your research was based, apartments performed very strongly, hadn't they?
They had. I did analysis last year, I think, looking at the distribution of growth for houses since 1980, obviously through to now. And what it showed is that typically houses tend to have growth spurts. So they'll have a spurt of growth that tends to last somewhere between 5 and 10 years. And that is typically then followed by a period of subdued growth, either nothing or maybe just at inflation, for again another 5 to 10 years, and it tends to move in cycles like that.
And each state's in a different stage of their cycle, aren't they? So sometimes Hobart will be the leading light, and then it'll be Brisbane and Adelaide. They've each had their turn, haven't they?
Exactly right. And there's a strong trend of mean reversion in all markets. So that is, eventually returns will revert to their mean, which means if you have periods of very low growth, typically you're going to get a period of very high growth, and the reverse is true as well. So in Melbourne, between 97 and 2010, apartments, this is just a median price, by the way, so it's not looking just at investment-grade apartments, but they grew at 10.7% compounding per annum over that period of time, that 13-year period. So it shows that apartments they do have the fundamentals, they can provide very attractive growth. And remember, that's just the capital growth rate there, Michael. We're not even talking about the rental yield. So we're looking at some pretty substantial returns over that period of time. Now, between 2010 and 2020, so the last 10 years, last decade, the median growth rate has only been 2.7%. So that's only just like a touch above inflation over that period of time, which I guess supports our observation that they really haven't grown very much over that time.
Well, we'll dig into this a bit further, because I think some people are going to wonder why. And the next question that springs into mind is, what should I do about it? So let's start with the why. Why do you think apartments, and again, we're talking in particular in Melbourne, but it was occurring in Brisbane as well, why have they underperformed?
Well, I think the first factor is supply side, that the supply of apartments, and particularly in investment grade locations, over the last 10 years have significantly increased. So if we look at, say, Sydney a decade ago, they were building about 6,000 to 8,000 apartments per quarter. And by 2016, it was around 18,000. In Melbourne, it was around sort of 10,000 apartments per quarter, and it peaked at sort of 15,000 apartments. So we've seen really a 50% or more supply increase. Remember, that's just looking at Melbourne data, so it's even worse in some particular suburbs. So I think what's happened is that, and we'll talk about who's been buying these apartments as well, which is part of the story, but developers have been looking for opportunities in those sorts of suburbs. Obviously, there's been a lot of high-rise development in the CBD, in and around the CBD, but then there's sort of secondary developments in really investment-grade suburbs. It typically occurs in, you know, busy main roads and those sorts of locations. And we can see it around, you know, for people that are from Melbourne, around places like South Yarra and Prahran and Richmond in particular, currently going through a sort of phase of construction. So obviously just basic economics, when demand increases and supply stays the same, we tend to get price growth. When demand increases and supply increases at the same rate, prices don't do anything. And I think that's the answer there. Now, the thing to recognize is that you can't really change the supply of houses in investment grade locations. You can through subdivision, but subdivision tends to happen in the second ring suburbs where land is a little bit cheaper. And Michael, you can speak to this far more intelligently than I can. But subdivision typically doesn't happen in high land value suburbs because it's just not economical in order to do that. So I guess we can just relatively safely assume you can't change supply of houses in those locations, but you can change the supply of apartments. If apartments were built pre-1970s, typically they might build, I don't know, 6 to 8 on a block. Whereas today on that same block, they would probably try and construct, well, they'd try and construct as many as possible, but that might be 20 or 30 apartments. So these developments where you end up getting really, I guess, anywhere from 20 to 100 apartments in any development, they materially change the supply of that sort of stock in that location, and the market has to have enough demand to absorb that supply increase.
Now, it's often said that an apartment still has a land component. The land component is that underlying assumption. If you've got 10 apartments on the block, a tenth of the land, and if it's a good location, that's the bit that goes up. While the new developers have the other intention, they put as many apartments on as possible, so the land component's on the smaller side. So why have the intrinsic value of these properties not gone up? Or is your suggestion that they have, but currently the market isn't reflecting the real underlying value?
I think the intrinsic value, I think if we believe that what has driven house prices higher is higher land values, and you certainly see that. I mean, you can observe, for example, again, in investment grade locations, you know, Victorian cottages that are 100 years old. Okay, they might have had some renovation and maintenance over time, but essentially the dwelling hasn't really changed very much, particularly over the last couple of decades. So what is then, if the dwelling value hasn't changed much, then it has to be the land value that's driving housing prices higher. Now, the logic then would tell us that if land values are higher, and I have an apartment with an intrinsic land value of, say, 50% of its overall total value is in land, then the intrinsic value must have increased over the same period of time. It's just impossible that it hasn't. And I think the only thing that's retarding or masking that increase is the fact of these new apartments coming online. Now, developers will almost reverse engineer it. They'll work out how much can we sell a one-bedroom apartment for, and maybe that's $450,000 or $550,000, whatever it is, and then they'll then spec out their development to work out, okay, what can we spend on the building, how many do we need to build in order to be able to sell at that price point. Now, if we have a whole bunch of stock coming online at selling for $450,000, $550,000, why am I going to pay $800 for an older style apartment that doesn't have stone bench tops and shiny new appliances and these sorts of things? You're just not going to. So we can then understand then how that not only just the supply of actual number of apartments have increased, but then if we look at the price points that these are coming to the market at, we can then understand why the intrinsic value isn't really reflected in these older style apartments.
But there's also a particular buyer segment that bought a lot of these apartments, and many of them were investors and many of them were overseas investors. They weren't really built for owner-occupiers or downsizers?
I mean, the last 10 years, there's been some developments that were purely built, constructed and marketed to overseas buyers. And just like what happened in Brisbane, I don't know, 15-odd years ago, where Brisbane developers were building apartments and selling them to people in Melbourne and Sydney, and the people, the locals in Brisbane, couldn't believe these guys were buying, you know, us Victorians and New South Welshmen were buying those sorts of stock. The same thing occurred with overseas buyers. And so in the 15 financial year, the Foreign Investment Review Board approved about $60 billion worth of residential purchases. In the 19 financial year, that's just under $15 billion, so a quarter of the amount. So we can certainly see over the last period of time that overseas buyers have dominated the market in segments and in geographical locations. And building a or speccing an apartment to sell overseas is a completely different prospect. You know, whereas you're selling to a local buyer, they're going to want a higher quality of finish. And so if I'm going to have to then, if I know, okay, overseas buyers are no longer dominating the market. And in fact, in 2019, the government put a 50% cap on overseas ownership. So now a developer can't sell any more than 50% of their apartment stock in a particular development to overseas buyers. So we now know that local buyers will be dominating the market. If that's the case, now I need to build, if I'm a developer, I need to build a higher spec property. I need to make sure the finishes are right, that the walls aren't paper thin. As you said in your opening, they're not built out of paper mache. And that's going to push the cost of these new developments up. So I can no longer sell, as using my example, a one bedder for $450 or $550. I'm going to have to charge maybe $800 for it. And then by comparison, if we're looking at just comparing price points, not actually finish or type of property, that's probably going to promote price growth in that investment grade sector as well.
I agree with you. In other words, the cost of new apartments is going to be much, much higher the next round of them for a couple of reasons. First of all, the different specs. The other is that with all the building issues that occurred a couple of years ago, it's going to be much harder to get a surveyor to approve it. They're going to look at it much more carefully. Builders are going to put a premium on building these because they're not going to want to get caught with problems like have occurred. And unfortunately, a lot of these complexes are all tarred with the same brush. There were some very good developments there, but everyone's going to be a little bit more cautious. That's going to add to the cost. And when you add to the fact that the banks are going to make it harder for people and fewer people are going to for developers to get the funding and fewer people are going to pre-purchase, buy off the plan at the moment, adding all that up means that the cost of the next round of apartments. And we're going to have to build them because we are growing our population. It's the only way to get more dwellings in bulk, either in apartments or out in the outer suburbs, because as you say, it's hard to subdivide where everyone wants to live in the middle ring suburbs. But all that together is going to make the next round of building much more expensive, the gap between the existing established apartments and the new apartments wider, and that's going to pull up the value. So I agree with you. I think currently investment-grade apartments are undervalued. But there's also a lot of dud apartments out there that are very likely to be the slums of the future. People are not going to want to live in those blocks that were poorly built, poorly designed, especially if there aren't as many overseas people coming here.
Yeah, I mean, you look at Opal Tower in Sydney where they had the cracking and the residents had to move out. In fact, there was a report more recently to say that their insurance premium, their building insurance premium, will increase from $100,000 a year to $2 million a year. So, you know, if you buy into a building that's poorly constructed, you have to live with that for a very long time because either you're going to continue to own it or if you try and sell it, no one's going to want to buy it. And then we're also reminded of that terrible disaster in London in 2017, Grenfell Tower. So the cladding issues as well. So I think people are going to be kind of buyer beware, particularly around new developments, and developers are going to have to react to that, and that will, without a doubt, lead to price increases for new stock.
I also think that some of the changes that are going to happen post-COVID are people are not going to want to necessarily be in lifts where everyone else is touching the lift button or have common facilities. So those more established apartments that don't have as many common facilities, that have balconies, that have got usable, livable balconies, not tiny balconies, that have got courtyards, they're going to be more in favour. And it's also likely that people are going to favour neighbourhood more. In other words, they're going to want to be within 20 minutes of the shops, the facilities, their gyms, rather than living in the CBD in those high-rise towers. So I can see a trend back to living in well-located apartments, what we used to call flats, investment-grade apartments, in lifestyle neighbourhoods. Neighbourhood's going to be an important factor moving forward.
And the other thing too is that those newer style stock are typically built on a busy main road. They're not in quiet streets, whereas the older style apartments are typically the reverse. They are in quiet streets. And then the other thing too is whilst we built something that was shiny and new 5 years ago, because they're constructed so poorly, they're going to wear and tear. And so they're going to either, they're either going to look terrible and be unappealing, or they're going to require the owners to start spending a lot of money on maintenance. And that's going to increase the cost. And for investors, that's obviously going to eat away at the rental yield. So they're not going to make great investments. And again, I think then that's what's going to push the older style apartments back into sort of a renaissance, if you like, knowing that they're so well constructed. If the building's been around for, a lot of them are double brick. Some, quite a lot of them are double. They're really well constructed. They're not going to fall down anytime soon, and that means that there's less maintenance to spend on.
Now, we know that one of the reasons investors bought in those new blocks was because of the depreciation allowances. They did it the wrong way. We don't advise, you don't advise your clients to buy for tax benefits, even though it's nice to have. But if they were to sell them on the open market now as established properties, those tax benefits don't apply to the next round of purchaser. So investors are not going to pay as much for them. And owner-occupiers, as we already said, aren't going to be as interested in them. So that's one of the reasons I was suggesting that some of those big blocks are going to be slums of the future. So some people would be wondering, well, should I buy a house? Is it fair to compare apartments to houses as investment alternatives?
It's probably not a fair comparison because we're talking about two different price points. You know, I think if your financial situation allows you to do so, then buying a house, if we're looking at the same location, if we're saying, okay, I want to invest in Hawthorne and Melbourne or Bondi in Sydney, what can I afford? And if you can afford a house, then I think that's probably a better proposition. You're going to get a higher land value component. You're going to be in a sub-asset class that cannot be changed. And whilst the rental yield is typically going to be lower, so less income, if you can stomach that, if you've got the financial position to be able to afford that, then I think that's what you should do. But if you're if you can't extend that far, then perhaps what you're probably comparing is, do I buy an apartment in Hawthorne or Bondi, or do I move further out and buy a house in a secondary location? And in that situation, I would always think that quality is key in the long run. In the shorter run, who knows? Like what happens over the next 5 years? No one really knows. But I think in the long run, quality is always going to rise to the top. And to my mind, I would much prefer to invest in Hawthorne or Bondi rather than move further out, even though we have to realise, and particularly investors over the last 10 years that have invested in these apartments now have been taught the lesson, we do need patience. We need to make a property investment and we need to understand we might have to wait 10 or 20 years to see the results. But if we buy the right asset, the results will always be there. The fundamentals shine through at the end of the day.
I agree with your principle that I'd rather own an apartment, the right sort of apartment, as we said, in a better location, because we know location does the bulk of the heavy lifting. And as we move forward, as our population grows, as immigration starts up again, more and more people are going to still want to live where the amenities are, where those neighbourhoods are, where those 20-minute neighbourhoods are, where you've got a choice of supermarkets, you've got a choice of school for your kids, you've got a choice of where you can shop, rather than the outer suburbs, which are not as well equipped with the amenities, not even with the public transport today, Stuart.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. These locations are always going to provide benefits. I think probably COVID is a good example of this, where people are thinking, okay, well, now we're all going to work from home permanently. We don't need to be in the city. But the things that determine where we'd like to live are multifaceted. It's not just about work. It's going to be about families. It's about healthcare and hospitals, and it's about leisure activities. It's about restaurants. And then it's also about a community and culture as well. A lot of these investment-grade suburbs have their sort of village atmosphere there, and that's the thing that sort of ties people to those sorts of locations, where you can go down to the shopping strip and have a coffee on a Saturday morning, and those sorts of things add a lot of amenity to locations. But being able to live in a quiet street, not have to contend with 100 other people that want to use the lift at the same time as you, these sorts of things as a long-term owner-occupier are going to be beneficial.
Sure. I think that's one of the things, as you say, we realized during COVID that people missed the ability to go to what's called the third place, the first place being your home, the second place being work. And the third place is where you meet your friends, where you go to the gym, where you go to have your coffee. Now, buying an investment apartment, some people think, hey, it's got these extra expenses of owner's corporation costs. But if you think about it, those costs you are what you'd have to pay if you owned just a house. You'd still have to pay for insurance, you'd still have to pay for maintenance, you'd still have to pay for the common area, which is all yours. But they're not set and forget. One of the things I like about the older apartments is that you can do them up, you can improve them, you can put new kitchens and bathrooms in to make them modern, to give them the stone finishes. So even if the market isn't doing the heavy lifting, you can manufacture some capital growth.
And it's incredibly important that your apartment block and that your individual apartment keeps up with the market. It needs to not only be tenantable, it needs to be comparable to what people are looking for in that particular location. So therefore, it's really important that you have a well-functioning body corporate, owner's corporation, I should say. That means that sometimes you might need to get on the board to help, the committee, I should say, to help with making decisions and steer it in the right direction. Spending nothing on maintenance, particularly around the building and common areas, it's a false economy. You need to spend money. You need to keep it up to a reasonable standard. You don't need to go nuts. But a lot of these older style apartments don't have lifts, don't have pools, don't have gyms. So there's less stuff to maintain, but they do have gardens. They might need painting and guttering. And as I said, the foyer or common areas might need to be given a bit of love over time and those sorts of things. But you need to make sure that you almost proactively manage your own investment. If the owner's corp is running fantastically well, then you're lucky and you don't need to do anything. But it's not just about being really passive and sitting back. Sometimes you need to be a bit more active, get in there and start making some changes and getting things happening. And then the same also internally within your apartment as well, making sure that, again, you don't need Miele appliances and stone bench tops, but you do need to make sure that it's relatively comparable, it's well maintained. And if you look after your property, typically your tenants will look after your property, but the reverse is true as well. If you don't look after it, give it a bit of love and care, then you can't really expect your tenants to.
Sure. I think one of the other points we missed out in our chat so far is the rental yield. So we've talked a lot about capital growth, but in general, houses, I've found, have more maintenance than apartments. So that's an outgoing that sometimes isn't taken into account in these headline numbers. And the yield on investment apartments is generally higher than the yield on houses, Stuart.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it depends on the location, of course. The differential tends to be around about 2% in terms of gross rental yield. And then, as you say, expenses typically are higher for a house as well. So that adds to the gap in terms of net rental yield, after expenses but before interest. So we have to take that into account. So when we're comparing capital growth rates of houses and apartments, of course, we're not necessarily looking for even numbers. There might be some disparity in that there's slightly lower growth in apartments, but we make it up on the income side typically. Having said that, still, over the last 10 years, they've underperformed, but something we need to think about. And also, it helps us investors for holding costs, which is probably less important today when interest rates are so low, but certainly important over the longer ownership periods.
Sure. So in summary, apartments have underperformed, but when people get your report, and there'll be a link in the show notes, they'll see that the cyclical nature, and you've drawn it out for Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane, how there are periods of strong growth and then flat periods. It's a cyclical growth. And it sounds like Melbourne and Brisbane in particular are set for the next stage of increased apartment values. But again, I think it's important to be selective and own the right property. I know you've got your calculators and we have also the cost of getting in and getting out. And sometimes it's easy just to throw your hands in there and say, oh, this is not no good. I'm going to get out. And maybe that's not the right decision without getting specific advice about you, your circumstances, and your particular property.
Yeah, and it's important not to be a passive investor as well. It's important to look at the performance, but then most important to understand the performance. So if I've got an investment-grade apartment and I've seen very little capital growth, my report will help you understand the performance, and we conclude then the fundamentals are sound. A lot of stuff that has occurred over the last 10 years are unlikely to reoccur, at least not to the same extent over the next 10 years. And that's probably going to change the capital growth rates. Whereas if you look at the performance of an asset and it's poor, but also then you start looking at the asset and it's poor, it doesn't have those sound fundamentals, then you need to make friends with the fact that, well, probably its fundamentals are lacking, and that's what's driving the returns, and therefore you need to potentially contemplate divesting of such asset. So looking at headline performance is good, but understanding what's driven that performance is exactly why I prepared the paper that I did.
I think a compliment to the paper would also be reading your book, The Rules of the Lending Game, because even in the last couple of months, the rules of the lending game have changed, with suggestions that in March 2021, there's going to be easier lending, and the Reserve Bank's attitude to lending as well. How's your book relevant to investors at the moment?
Well, I think it's very relevant because it's about maximizing your borrowable equity. So if I have more capital to invest, then I can either invest in a higher quality, a better quality asset, or I can invest in more assets. And I know that if I buy the right assets, I hold them for long term, I be patient, I know that's what's going to drive ultimately investment returns and help me achieve my lifestyle and financial goals. So maximizing your access to investment capital, that is borrowings, for most of us, is critically important. And of course, these rules are always changing, and different banks will have different rules and different banks will have different approaches to rules. But I'm really optimistic about the potential changes that might come through next year, Michael, and particularly for people that are spending more than the average, they're going to benefit the most. I was looking at a client yesterday, and at the moment he can borrow around an additional $850,000, and he's got an actual cash flow surplus of around about $80,000 a year. So he's very strong on cash flow, he's very strong in equity, but his borrowing capacity is limited. I estimate that if they push through, and we haven't seen any of the detail of the changes, right? But if I look at what they have done in the past and I start extrapolating what those changes might look like next year, I estimate that maybe this client's borrowing capacity will increase to maybe $1.5 to $1.6 million. That's a considerable difference. At $850,000, he can't buy a house in Melbourne. But at $1.5 million, he most definitely can buy a house in Melbourne. And that changes his investment prospects. And it also is investment opportunities and risks. So these changes that might come through could be, excuse the pun, game changes. But you need to know the rules of the game, which is really which are written by the government and the banks. And then you've got to play those rules to your advantage. And that's what my book. Hopefully, that's what my book helps you achieve.
Oh, it does. And I'll leave a link to that in the show notes as well. But I think one of the things I learned was that we all have a lending ceiling. In the old days, it wasn't as hard as that. You could keep borrowing. But today, just like your client has, his ceiling will increase, but he'll still have a limit to what he can borrow, no matter what his income is, what his business is generating. So One of the things you've often said is the importance of using that wisely. If you can only buy one or two properties or three or four, whatever your limit is, make sure they're the best assets you can have, because you're going to be maxed out financially. There's more opportunities than your money is going to allow you to buy, Stuart.
Quality trumps quantity every day of the week. I would much rather own one fantastic quality asset than three very average quality assets. And quite often, you know, you would meet them too, Michael. People come to you and say, I want to buy a property portfolio of 10 properties over the next 3 years or something like that. It sounds good and it might sound attractive to our egos, but it means nothing. I would much rather, as I said, it's all about the quality. So it's really about, I want to invest in the best quality properties I can get my hands on. If that's one property, it's fine. If it's two properties, that's good. If it's three, it's fine too. You probably don't need 10. And most people, if they're going to seek to go and buy 10 properties, they're going to start compromising on quality.
So in summary, apartments are still going to be a way more and more Australians are going to live. There's going to be more of them built over the future, as we've got to accommodate all the people coming to live in Australia, which is and remains the best place in the world to live. So I wouldn't discard apartments as investments, but you've got to own the right apartment in the right location. And if your apartment hasn't performed that well, I think you're going to get some comfort from Stuart's report, which is going to show you why and why you can look forward to better times ahead. Thanks for your time today, Stuart.
My pleasure, Michael.
In a moment, I'm going to share my mindset message with you. But before I do, just harking back on my conversation with Stuart a moment ago, you'll realise that not all properties make good investments, and sometimes even investment-grade properties, or what you may think are investment-grade properties, won't perform as well. Now, we're into a new stage of the property cycle. We've worked our way through many of the challenges of COVID, but they haven't all gone away. And a lot of the challenges of the economic fallout from the recession haven't hit us yet. On the other hand, there are some great opportunities in our property markets, with a whole lot of factors causing growth drivers that are going to drive certain segments of our property markets. So to secure your financial future, you're going to need much more than just a buyer's agent. You're going to need somebody who understands with a holistic approach about wealth creation. You're going to need more than even a property strategist. And my team at Metropole offer a holistic approach to ensure you can grow your wealth, but also to protect it and pass on your wealth, because we have wealth advisory and financial planning and property acquisition, value add through renovations or development, property management. But it all starts with tailoring a customized solution to meet your specific needs with a strategic property plan. So if you want to take advantage of the new wave of the property cycle, if you want to ride this new wave, have a chat with my team at Metropole and let us help you. metropole.com.au, or there'll be a link in the show notes. I'd love to be part of your wealth creation journey.
Now here's Michael's mindset message. Remember, a change in your thinking will lead to a change in your life.
In today's mindset message, I'd like to talk to you a bit about worries. In fact, the evolution of worrying and how in the past it may have been protective, but why today it may not be as useful as that. Think about it. Thousands of years ago, it was part of what kept humans alive. Is that a lion in the bush? Was it that tiger? 9 out of 10 times, there probably was no large saber-toothed animal out there to pounce, but worrying saved lives. Often this then became ingrained. But fast forward to the present day. You're probably listening to this on your smartphone, and you probably don't have to worry about things that our ancestors did, but I bet that doesn't stop you from worrying, does it? Today, instead of being hypervigilant about big, scary predators that could actually kill us, we obsess about the economy, the property markets, our job security, the value of our homes, or other sources of possible inconvenience. But there are two problems with this. Firstly, most of the things we worry about just don't happen. And secondly, even if they do happen, worrying doesn't really help, does it? Today, rather than keep us alive, our worries are more like spinning on a wheel in a ditch, they tend to be pointless, ineffective, and often border, for some people at least, on compulsive and neurotic. So my recommendation to you today is to get out of your worry rut, but this takes practice and this takes determination. So next time you feel stuck in a rut of worries, try asking yourself these simple questions. Firstly, ask yourself, what's the worst thing that can happen? If death, dismemberment, or complete financial collapse is actually occurring to you right now, well, okay, you're allowed to keep worrying. If not, just get back to work. The second question to ask yourself is, when I worried about this in the past, did it actually help? If you think about it, worrying about things almost never helps. If it isn't helping, then why worry? Why keep doing it? And the third question to ask yourself is this a now problem or a then problem? How often have you created a problem of mythical proportions? Oh, look, I've lost my iPhone. Somebody's stolen it. I'm going to become a victim of identity theft. I need to discover that in reality it wasn't a problem at all. Oh, look, there it is. It's left inside my car. So don't confuse then with now. Think of all the mental energy we can free up for our family, for creative pursuits, for even earning a bit more money on the side if we stop worrying incessantly, if we stop worrying unnecessarily. Now, I'm not saying never worry. I'm just gently suggesting not to get stuck in the rut of continuously worrying. Try and keep your worrying in a healthy groove instead. Well, I hope you got some benefit from today's show and learned a bit more about apartments and what makes a good investment and how to plan your financial future. Now, if you got some benefit, I'd love for you to help somebody else who'd also benefit from this by just telling them about the Michael Yardney podcast or use the share button on the podcast app. In between these twice weekly shows, you can catch me on social media or, of course, in my daily property update blog. And if you'd like to tell the world about this show, why not leave me a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Spotify, wherever you listen to this podcast. I'll be back real soon, twice a week. In the meantime, have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney podcast, which was brought to you by Metropole, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney Podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropole to help you?